Welcome to Everything STEAM. I'm your host, Sam Stanford. As a physicist and structural engineer with Jacobs Engineering, I've made many connections with some bright individuals who are either working, studying, or self-taught and passionate about our particular topics of discussion. Unless you live under a rock in the U.S. and your name is Patrick Starr, you would know that there is a water crisis going on in the western portion of the states. In this episode, my guests and I cover the history, current state, and future of the Colorado River Basin, with a heavy emphasis on how water is being used and distributed, and what technologies could potentially save the situation. We mention water policy, foreign affairs, farming tactics, cloud seeding, water bottles, us versus them mentality, and you guessed it, beavers. To help me better communicate these topics to you, I brought in a very special guest, so please meet Teal Leto. Teal, aka Western Water Girl, is a water rights activist located in Durango, Colorado. Teal currently runs a TikTok account dedicated to water conservation issues in the Colorado River Basin with over 55,000 followers, and was actually featured in NPR's Morning Edition and the BBC's Panorama for her advocacy work on the platform. Teal became a certified raft guide before attending college and founded the first junior women's raft racing team in the United States. Her team won the 2017 U.S. Rafting Championships and represented the country at the World Rafting Championships in 2017 and 2018. Teal then attended Fort Lewis College, where she founded a club dedicated to water resource issues in the Southwest, and then graduated in 2020 with a degree in environmental studies and political science. These experiences created a deep love for rivers and whitewater, and respect for the connections that they bring across cultural barriers. So, now that you've been introduced to Teal and the topic of this podcast, we're going to head into the first segment where we plan to talk about the current water situation. Teal, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
This isn't your first podcast. You've done this many times.
Definitely been on a couple of podcasts before.
So I feel very privileged to announce the fact that Teal was actually happy to record with me, because it's one of the most thorough approaches that she's encountered in terms of like a podcast. So
I appreciated it a ton.
Which is funny. Like I feel like all we did was just create an outline and kind of go through it step by step, which I thought that was kind of a normal thing. Well, I guess for maybe like something more scientifically minded like this, or more structured, you know, like other podcasts just get together and talk about a movie, which, don't get me wrong, those are cool podcasts too, which is, I don't think they really need structure. But anyways, so we're talking about the Western water crisis. Not all doom and gloom, I promise. It's going to be exciting. Talk about policy and also talk about what is happening to combat the water crisis in the West. Western United States, by the way, because there are listeners that are from different parts of the world for this podcast. Before we jump into anything and I start asking Teal a bunch of questions, I have a couple of fun facts that I really want to go through that I think will really enlighten the audience. I know, like, for the typical audience that I have, they've probably heard this before, but might as well reiterate it. And I actually think I have a TikTok video about the second fun fact. So the first fun fact that like blows my mind, and it's a numbers fun fact, is that there are more H2O molecules, water molecules, in a cup of water than there are cups of water on the whole earth, which is interesting. Wow. There's about 5 sextillion cups of water on earth. And I wanted to keep it kind of even and talk about cups. The sextillion is 10 to the 21st. So if you compare that to the amount of water molecules in one cup of water, it's about 8,400 sextillion water molecules in a cup of water. So yeah, it's by standards not even close, actually. It's really interesting. The second one is the leading hypothesis to how water formed on Earth. And this is the TikTok that I was alluding to. So if I don't do a very good job explaining it, just go watch the TikTok. So there's the protoplanetary disk that happened, you know, after a supernova event. And where Earth is stationed is, you know, more on the interplanetary disk. The more the heavy elements are located in towards the center, and the lighter elements are scattered more towards the edges. And that's, you know, like hydrogen. For example, like, you know, the heavier elements like iron, oxygen, you know, stuff like that, nitrogen, were more closer to where Earth formed. And the hypothesis is that how we obtained our water is through stardust and sky pebbles. Essentially, we lacked hydrogen, free hydrogen. We still technically do. And the way that we obtained those was from those media. So obviously, we know that the sun is nuclear fusion, and one of the byproducts of that is ionized particles, hydrogen. And so it will bombard Earth, and that's one way. Then the second way is through comets, meteors, and whenever they bombard, they also share hydrogen. So in the Hadean Eon, which was the time of Earth where it was extremely hot and molten and there wasn't really tectonic plates formed or anything like that, there was a lot of free-floating oxygen molecules in the atmosphere. And over time, what happened is this fusing of these, you know, space dust and sky pebbles would fuse and create water vapor. And then over time, as the Earth cooled, the idea is that it condensed and fell down as water or oceans. So, yeah, that's the two fun facts that I have for you. I'm done. Everything else is on Teal. So have a good one.
Those were dense fun facts. The first one reminds me of like the subreddit that's like, they did the math.
That is true. I did a teensy bit of math on that one. It was more Googling than it was math for me. So somebody did it. And then I was just like, yeah, that's cool. Let's share that with everybody. So I don't take credit. I guess to start out segment one, we should probably talk about how much water there is globally and then shrink it down to the West. So do you have any comments on global water? What are we dealing with water on Earth?
Well, there's a couple of things that come to mind. First off, only 3% of the water on Earth is fresh water. And of that 3%, only like 1.2 is accessible for us to actually use, which is problematic for us because a lot of it is locked up in like ice and permafrost and in the
groundwater.
In groundwater. Well, a lot of the groundwater is accessible for us. We do have some groundwater that is like super deep and it's difficult for us to access. But for the most part, we're using our groundwater resources. There's actually a lot of studies about the fact that we are draining our groundwater resources really rapidly, but I digress. The second thought I have about water on a global scale is that it's really important to remember that the climate crisis is going to impact water resources before a lot of other natural resources that we rely on, which is also quite problematic because we need water to survive. So there's like some other things like timber or oil, other resources that we might be able to transition away from. But it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to survive without fresh water.
That actually goes into some of the statistics that we could really talk about water usage, especially towards like the Western portion. Like petroleum takes a lot of water to, you know, refine and also use into their certain products that comes from petroleum, which is just overarching, say it that way. And then obviously the timber industry. As you continue to degrade the soil and remove the forest and try to regrowth, the ability to hold water in there just decreases. And it just increases the amount of water that is needed to continuously create a crop to harvest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Forest health is really closely tied to watershed health as well.
One thing that I thought was interesting, because I did also look at some of the global numbers for water, and it was from the USGS. And it was weird to me that only like 0.001% is in the atmosphere. I was kind of blown away by that because it is like water vapor is one of our most abundant greenhouse gas. I mean, it's more of a product of greenhouse gases. So we just claim it as a greenhouse gas. But essentially, that's a small percentage. I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, we could see that change as temperatures rise because the amount of water vapor that our atmosphere can hold like goes up exponentially as temperatures rise linearly. So that's one of my biggest fears and climate anxieties is the fact that like a lot of our water resources may not be accessible because they will be in the atmosphere in the future.
Yeah, most definitely. That would not be good. So I think from a global standpoint, I do want to state numbers. If there is any number files out there that just absolutely go bonkers for numbers. The Earth's water estimate is 326 million trillion gallons. That's 326 quintillion gallons, if you're loving that. And then just to reiterate, that's fresh water is only 3%, which is really sad. But let's narrow it down and let's talk about the West. What do you have for me for Western water?
Yeah, well, first off, I want to start out with out West, we measure water in acre feet. So none of those numbers mean anything to me.
Poor metric system.
I know. I'm sorry. But people are always like, oh my God, that is the stupidest unit of measurement. And I'm like, trust me, like there's reasoning behind it, but I kind of agree. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. Anyways, out West, our water resources are very strained. Specifically, my work is focused on the Colorado River. And so for the purposes of this podcast, I'm probably going to be speaking mostly about Colorado River and the Colorado River Compact. There are a lot of other river systems in the West, but a lot of them face the same issues that the Colorado River does. So it's like really emblematic of all of the issues with water in the West. But the Colorado River is governed by something called the Colorado River Compact, which was written in 1922. It is the document that all of the seven states in the Colorado River Basin agreed to that governs how much water each state gets. The seven states in the Colorado River Basin are Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and California. And they basically wrote that because at the turn of the century, the other states besides California were really worried that California was developing like way too quickly. And so the other states were like, whoa, hold on, like you're going to siphon all this water. Because the way it works in the West is the first person to divert water from a stream is entitled to the entire right that they have on that stream before any other users. And that's even true for people who might not even be using that water in the river basin that that stream is in. So in California, a lot of the water is actually pumped like up and out of the Colorado River Basin. So the other states were like, yo, Congress, we need you to help us by creating this like compact so that we can make sure that in the future we'll have water to develop with and California won't just take all of it. But unfortunately, when they decided to make this contract, they hugely overestimated the amount of water that would be in the Colorado River. They assumed, based on a period of really wet years at the turn of the century, that there would be about 16.5 million acre feet within the river every year to be used. So they allocated 7.5 million acre feet to the upper basin and 7.5 million acre feet to the lower basin. And the lower basin states are Nevada, California, and Arizona. And the upper basin states are Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico. And the upper basin states get 7.5 million acre feet, lower basin states get 7.5 million acre feet, and then Mexico is supposed to get 1.5 million acre feet. And that's the full 16.5 million. I want to really stress here at this junction that we did not consider the needs of any of the indigenous people at that time. So we did not allocate any water to them, which we will get back to that.
And also, can I just butt in and say, like, just FYI, we're not talking about policy yet, but just take note of the fact that that was made in 1922. This is 2023.
We got some antiquated rules going on here. And it turns out that the average for the last like 900 years in the Colorado River Basin is something like 14.3 million acre feet. And since the turn of the millennia, since 2000, the average has been something closer to like 12.4 million acre feet. So we're looking at about a 4 million acre foot budget deficit every year. And we are using every single drop and then some. Like we're reusing it downstream. There are people, especially indigenous people, who have water rights that are called paper water rights because they have a right to that water, but it never materializes. They don't actually have access to it. So this whole structure kind of set up a system that really is inflexible to change because it's like these really specific numbers. And also this was created at a time when we were actively homesteading the West. We were still like in the process of like settling out there. I know it was like kind of at the tail end, but we were really encouraging people to farm out there. So that's where the purpose of this like water management system came from. And that's also why a significant portion of the water that we use today still goes to farming. So it's frustrating for me because a lot of times people want to point fingers at cities and be like, golf courses, like golf courses is the problem. And like, don't get me wrong, I got my own problems with golf, but it's not to do with water. It's like cities only use about 10% of the water in the river basin, and then industry uses another 10%, and then agriculture uses about 80% of the water in the Colorado River Basin. The thing is, it kind of varies like which state you look at. For example, in Arizona, 70% of their water goes to agriculture, and the cities use a little bit more. And I think in Nevada, the cities use a lot of the water because they don't have as much agriculture there. And so it does vary state to state.
If you want like accurate numbers, I have an actual thing cited here from the Journal of Nature. That there was a study that was conducted in 2020, and they looked at 17 Western states. I know it's a little bit larger footprint than what you're talking about, but it took into account that for 115 million individuals, like just residential, that's only 6% of the water in those 17 states. And then whenever you added commercial and industrial, the total was about 14%. 14%, 86% of that was then guided towards agriculture.
So. Absolutely. And then like CSU has a water knowledge like hub that you can check out with a bunch of data that's specific to Colorado, because they have a whole campus dedicated to studying like agriculture and stuff like that. And in Colorado, 89% of water goes to agriculture.
Wow.
So it really does depend on like the state. But to me, I really do support the agricultural communities in the basin, and I want to stress that at this juncture, because I think a lot of times when you start pointing the finger at ag and saying how much water it uses, people start getting a little defensive, and they're like, well, what are you going to eat, and that kind of stuff. And I want to be really clear that I do support farmers.
Yes.
Like, we do need to eat. However, absolutely. I do want to throw it out there that the majority of the water that's being used for agriculture in the Colorado River Basin is being used to grow forage crops for cattle. Fox News just did a huge expose about this, and it was really had all these like really awesome little graphics and like a breakdown on it. And I really recommend checking it out. But it was like 60% of the water in the Colorado River Basin is going towards feeding cattle, and not all of the cattle that it's going towards feeding are in the United States. We do export a lot of it. And all that is to say that I think there is ways we could be using our water to produce food that's a little bit more efficient, maybe a little bit less consumptive of water. I'm not a militant vegan. It's just like, I read one study that was from, I can't remember the journal. I'll send you a link when I'm done.
But
they were talking about how if Americans all just chose to do like a beefless Mondays or like beefless Fridays, we could probably like single-handedly solve the water crisis in the West.
Yeah, so I think the statistic is the average American consumes like 4 times the amount of beef. Like if you look at a worldwide standard, of course, like I eat meat too. The message isn't, you know, let's all stop eating meat. The idea is just to consume a little less.
Yeah. I mean, like, to be honest, I'm not giving up cheese anytime soon. So like, I totally understand, but we do have to look at our food systems and the way that they're using our resources to kind of consider and like weigh a cost benefit analysis in the face of like such an unprecedented drought. Like, we'll probably get into this at some point in time, but, the drought, everybody's like, oh, we had this amazing snow season, drought's over. But like Colorado as a state, for example, left drought for all of 4 days and we're already back into drought. It was the first time in 4 years that Colorado had been drought free. And like literally it was for like a week, 4 or 5 days. And then my region is already back in abnormally dry conditions. So it's not enough to have like one really good winter. We're looking at these like long-term trends of how much water is in the system, and we're just over budgeting. Like we're using way, way too much water.
It's a very dynamic situation, like in terms of looking at it geologically, or I guess hydrologically, both. If you want to just say earth science in an earth science manner, because the built environment, which can also incorporate like what we do for agriculture, pretty much causes a drought based system. I mean it like if you just have normal soil deposition, you're going to have a decently aerated medium that could potentially push air out and be filled and saturated with water. Now, as you create a built environment in some spectrum of a manner, you're going to end up compressing that medium. And when you compress that medium, what happens is you have less air to be filled with water.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that water does not want to seep into the ground very well. That eliminates the possibility for groundwater, but also increases the ability for floods and also increases the ability for droughting, because water will lay on top of the surface, it gets attacked by the sun and it evaporates. So you're eliminating a key portion of the water cycle, which is having surface water go to groundwater. It's dynamic, but it's simplistic enough to just say that like our built environment is affecting the water cycle and it's creating more drought.
Absolutely. And then I think you're very much like a physical sciences person, I can tell. I'm very much a policy person. And so when I look at this problem, I see all of the ways that like our political institutions and like our legal institutions have been set up to perpetuate this issue for like eternity until we like run it into the ground, which is so frustrating.
Makes sense. I think before we get into that, the last thing that we really wanted to talk about was climate change and its effects on water consumption or just water in general in the West. Do you want to give us a briefing on that?
Absolutely. I don't think I'm going to be the first person to tell all y'all that the West is getting hotter and drier. It's a fact. It's hotter and drier out here. I don't think anybody this summer is looking at the West being like, ooh, that looks nice. Because it's literally been like 85 in my house for like a month now. A lot of people in the high mountains like don't have air conditioning. And so when it gets to like over 90, 100 for like weeks at a time, it's pretty problematic in this region. And it's been happening more and more often. As I was already talking about earlier, when it's hotter, more water can evaporate. And so yeah. We're really losing a lot of our water resources before we can even get our hands on them. I actually am working on a video that'll be released probably around the same time as this podcast. So you can check it out. But it's about this whole issue of like our snowpack sometimes is totally normal. And then the stream flow in the river is only like 30% of average. And that's because a lot of that water is sublimating before we can get to it. So it's evaporating before it even assumes its liquid form. But also the soils get a lot drier when it's hotter out. And so the soils soak up a lot of the water. And then plants have this thing called evapotranspiration rates, which is how much water they need to survive. And that skyrockets as it gets hotter and drier. So we are looking at like an environment that will be siphoning away more and more of our water before we can get our hands on it. And it's going to be so hot that we need more and more water to survive, because most people in the West use evaporative cooling as their method for cooling their homes. And you can't do that without water.
Between what she just said and what I said about affecting the water cycle, I think that's pretty much all you can really sum up in terms of how climate change is affecting water and how it's being consumed. It's just altering the landscape. You can point in many different directions, but it just ends up being a positive feedback loop in so many different manners. It's extremely dynamic, unfortunately. We could literally make an entire podcast about it. Maybe on a later date.
Yeah, I think we can leave it at like the UN calls the climate crisis a water crisis. And I agree.
One more quick thing. We're getting an increased amount of water vapor into the atmosphere, which is increasing severity, but also variability of like weather. And then, you know, on a larger time scale climate. So that's also something to take into account. So obviously places are getting more dry. There's more drought occurring, more water scarcity based on how we define what's going on with water, but also we're getting places that are becoming extremely more wet and then events are becoming more severe.
Yeah. And I think that's like related to my point of like this winter, we had a great winter, but that doesn't mean like climate change isn't real or that like we're not going to go back into drought. Like that's actually exactly what scientists have been telling us, is that we're going to have these like weird yo-yo cycles where it's like we have no snow and then we have a ton of snow and then we have no snow. And that's really, really difficult for water managers to like plan for.
That's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. Because I feel like we're just plugging videos at this point. I literally just made a video. I literally just made a video about like how until like the average temperature in the winter gets above, you know, the melting point, you're going to see these crazy snowfalls. And then once you get that above average temperature, or if you just have an anomaly event where things deep freeze and then you just happen to have a lot of precip, it could be snowfall. But if the average temperature is above 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees Celsius, you're going to end up seeing more larger rain events in the winter time than snow events in the winter time. Again, back to this whole dynamics. And the problem is we don't really think about weather or climate because it's hard for us to really picture something that takes place, you know, a third, two thirds or over our entire lifetime. Mm-hmm. But we have to get a sense of, you know, how these events do play into climate and how it's getting more severe, and how temperature is affecting these events. Sorry, I ranted.
No, I absolutely agree. I was literally saying, I don't know what else to add there, because that's also how I just get a lot of comments that are like, oh, the drought is over. And it's like, well, for today, but the reality is, like, we see the long-term trends and we have to rectify the situation with the huge deficit that we created when we wrote the Colorado River Compact. Because even ignoring the last decade of 12.4 million acre feet, the real average is at least 2 million acre feet lower than what we assumed it was going to be. And like, that's it without even considering climate change. And we have to rectify that situation before it all just like hits the ground. Because like, we're quickly approaching like a huge catastrophe in the river basin. And I think it's probably worth explaining that just for a quick second, because sure, I don't think people really understand like what's at stake.
Yeah.
And we have two main reservoirs in the system that I'm going to focus on, and that's Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And like, Lake Powell is basically like the savings account for the lower basin, and Lake Mead is like the checking account for the lower basin. And the way the compact was written, like, the lower basin is going to get their water no matter what. The upper basin just has to deal with, like, if there's less than 15 million acre feet, they just deal with that shortage. But the lower basin is going to get their amount no matter what, essentially. I'm kind of like making a reductivist argument here, but that's essentially how it works. And we are quickly approaching water levels, but we have a little bit more leeway, but we're still not that much higher than them. But we're approaching water levels in these reservoirs that could result in them reaching what's called dead pool, which is where water can no longer leave the dams. And in Lake Powell, there's actually another water level before that called minimum power generation pool. And that's the amount of water we need, the level that we need to be able to push water through the turbines. And Glen Canyon Dam, it makes a significant amount of the power that the Western United States uses. And it's also one of the only places where they can, what they call like black start nuclear power plants. So that if the nuclear power plant happens to shut down, they can like restart it using energy from Lake Powell. And it hasn't, like, that system has not been rerouted to other dams yet. And last year we were like feet, like a handful of feet away from reaching that minimum power pool, which could have like destabilized the entire Western electrical grid. And then looking further, before this winter, the BOR was putting out projections that Lake Mead could reach dead pool by 2026, which would mean all 20 million of the users below Lake Mead would no longer have access to Colorado River water, which is like a big deal.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's why the federal government was like, yo, everybody, we need to cut our usage by like 2 to 4 million acre feet. And that didn't happen. We had this awesome winter, so it kind of gave us some more time to figure it out. And they came to like an interim agreement, but they are going to be negotiating new rules in the very near future to figure out how to rectify this deficit.
Wow. Okay. So two things. I knew about the scarcity level, but I did not know that it was affecting the power grid in that manner. I knew that there was a lot of people at stake for hydrological power, but I didn't even know that it was also affecting nuclear power. I'm a little blown away, but
yeah.
Wow, okay. I think that's a good place where we can stop, because whenever we come back for segment two, we're going to talk about how the system's broken. Have you ever been standing in the shower, looking at the ingredients on your shampoo bottle, and noticed that water is always the first ingredient? Well, I have. After a little research, I discovered that shampoo is over 80% water, which is kind of like dumping bottled water on your head while you're standing in a shower. And that's why I'm excited that I found Seabar, a disposable plastic-free hair care line that cleans up ocean trash with every purchase. Not only does Seabar pick up 1 pound of ocean trash for every item ordered, but their salon-quality shampoo and conditioner concentrates come from refillable applicators, kind of like deodorant tubes. Just twist them up, rub it on over your hair a couple times, and then just lather it up like you normally would. My favorite part is how long they last. I've personally been using the same Seabar for 3 months now, and I've barely used any. So not only does it help save the environment, it's also effective, efficient, and most importantly, it saves me money. If you would like to try a better way to wash your hair, head on over to Seabar.com and use our special code STEAM for 15% off your first order. Seabar,
Shampoo done right for you and the planet.
Okay, we are back. This is segment two, and we're going to talk about why the system is broken. And I'm just going to take a backseat on this. And if I have questions, I'm going to be asking them because Teal is top tier on this. So what do you got for us?
Yeah, well, we're going to start from the beginning. So back in the 1860s, the American government was like, yo, let's send a bunch of white folks out west to homestead. So they gave people 160 acre plots that they could keep basically for free as long as they were farming it. And this also contributed a lot to the removal of indigenous people in the West. And I just want to like throw that out there that that's definitely, they're related. And I want to acknowledge that it was hugely problematic for those people. And I don't support what our government did there. But it did set up our entire water rights system in the West. Because back in the East, water rights are governed by riparian water law, which basically is that like if you have water running through your property, then you have access to that water. And that worked out pretty well because there was water like everywhere in the East. So if you get a piece of property, you're probably going to end up with some kind of water source on it. But when these homesteaders started coming out to the West, they were like, oh my God, it is dry as all heck out here. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Rango, but there's like a scene in the movie where he like gets ejected from his little like tank and he's like in the highway and he literally just like spontaneously combusts and like, like he like sheds his skin twice because it's just like so dry. That's what it's like out here. So these people would get this 160 acre lot, which you would think like, yeah, there's got to be water on there, and there would be no water. So now they're like pumping water over from other places. And that meant they had to create a new system for water management. So they created this thing called the Doctrine of Prior Appropriation. And I kind of mentioned it earlier, but basically people refer to it as like first in time, first in right. The first person who diverts water from a stream, even if it's not on their property, has a right to all of the water they diverted before any other user. So that creates a lot of issues, but also I want to say that for some reason that system does not apply to the indigenous people in this area. Jeez. And that's hugely, hugely problematic. And we're going to circle back to that in just a second here. But I'm actually going to explain another factor of this that's really problematic, which is that in order to prevent people from just like randomly like digging ditches and like diverting water for no purpose to like sell it later with like a really good water right, they made this rule that you had to use your water right or lose it. So you couldn't just like claim water and then not use it for 10 years and then sell it later. So at the time, this rule like had a purpose. But now it's basically preventing farmers and irrigators from being able to use more efficient irrigation methods and plant better crops because they have to use the entirety of their water right, or they might lose the unused portion in the future. This really discourages them from being willing to make any changes towards efficiency or conservation. That being said, there are a ton of farms that still participate in those programs. It's just, it is like an overall cultural feeling that like you have to use all your water. Where I live at the end of the growing season, farmers will just like flood their fields.
Yep.
And they have to use all the water. Super frustrating. At the same time, there's at least 22 recognized indigenous tribes in the Colorado River Basin. I think the last time I checked, some people were saying it was up to 30. But there are a ton of indigenous peoples in the Colorado River Basin. And the Supreme Court ruled in 1908 that indigenous tribes have a right to water to supply every irrigable acre on their land. And typically when we irrigate things, we flood them and we'll flood them about a foot deep. So now this whole acre foot measurement is making a lot more sense.
Yeah.
That's how we measure things. But these tribes were left out of the original Colorado River Compact, and so now they have to settle for these water rights that should be dated to the creation of their treaties with the states that they live in. And some of those states have been fairly amenable to that settlement. For example, Colorado settled back in the 1980s. Those tribes they've settled their water rights. They know their priority dating. But in Arizona, a significant portion of the tribes are still waiting to receive their water, especially a tribe that I think a lot of people are familiar with because it's one of the largest indigenous tribes in the United States is the Navajo Nation. And the Navajo Nation is really struggling to gain access to the water rights that they should be entitled to with the state of Arizona. So 1 in 3 homes in the Navajo Nation lacks access to basic drinking water. So they don't have running water in their homes, 1 in 3 homes, which is crazy. And on top of that, like, the Navajo Nation just paid $128 million to build a hospital near their capital. And they can't open its doors because they can't secure water to be able to operate the hospital. And I don't know how many of your listeners have been to the Navajo Nation, but it is a very desolate landscape. And it's a very long ways to medical services. So it was a really big deal for them to build this hospital. And it was completed, I think, in 2022. And they haven't been able to open its doors yet.
My understanding is just with the first come, first serve kind of a deal. Obviously, like, people were given like a piece of paper to be able to start this whole irrigation process. And then indigenous peoples just didn't end up getting that piece of paper. Is that pretty much?
Yeah. So you appropriate it, which is when you actually like build the ditch and start using it, which it doesn't work that way anymore, but it used to. Now you have to do the next step, which is called adjudicate. I'm speaking of the state of Colorado because every state has like different laws, but this is how it works in Colorado. You go to the water court, and they are a special court system that just has to do with adjudicating water rights. And they'll tell you, like, this is the date that your water right has. And it goes into, like, a log that the state has of every water right on every stream. And it's tied to your property. So when you sell, like, your piece of property, the water rights date and the amount of water right you have can affect the value of the property, which is why a lot of those ranchers are really opposed to reducing the amount of water they use, because in the future they could lose that water from their water right, which thereby lowers their property value. And so they're like literally being punished for trying to conserve water.
Wow, that's insane. I can see why the system's broken.
And then on top of that is, like, the way the system is set up, there's no like cap to the number of people who can place rights on a stream. You know, you'll have your most senior right on the stream who's like definitely going to get all of their water, but you could have like 300 other junior rights, and maybe like 50 of them just never materialize. They never get their water. And then in times of drought, maybe like 100 of them don't get their water, but the first 100 will. And that most senior water rights holder will always get all of their water. And in times of drought, the junior users will be like cut off in succession, which means that these water scarcity issues are not being shared equally. They're mostly affecting the people who have more junior water rights. And at this point, a lot of the senior water rights in Colorado River Basin have been bought out by corporate entities.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're saying, like, in a time of drought, the most senior person, let's just say they get 100 acre feet. And then whether it's drought or wet, they still get 100 acre feet. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. But say they're like, say the next person, there's only 100 acre feet that year in the stream, then like that senior water rights holder gets all that 100 acre feet and the next person just gets none. It's not like the next person gets like 50 and the senior water rights holder gets 50. Legally speaking, the junior water rights holder gets none. Now, I do want to put a caveat in there, which is that like a lot of these water communities, they're run by like ditch companies and stuff like that. And they're like very tight knit rural communities. So amongst irrigators, a lot of times they'll end up working something out where like the junior user will get like maybe 25 acre feet or something. So they're not like totally cut out. But like legally speaking, the senior water rights holder is entitled to their entire water right before any other user on the stream. And now we're going to get into another step, which I actually forgot to mention to you when we wrote our outline, but it just popped into my head.
Bonus.
We didn't recognize ecosystems and environments as like a viable use of water until the 1970s. So we really genuinely would like fully appropriate an entire river and like suck it dry until the 1970s. We were like, whoa, we should probably make rights for these streams so they don't like run dry and all the fish die, which literally happens on a river near me every other year. Like if it's a drought year, the river dries and like most of the fish die. It's so sad. So the state of Colorado, at least in the 1970s, was like, we'll make these in-stream flow rights. But like, what good is a water right if it dates to 1970 when most of the water rights on the river are from like the 1860s? Like that only serves a purpose when there's already enough water in the stream. And then that's kind of looking at like in between individual users. But on the grand scale, like the grand scheme of things with the Colorado River Compact, it's also set up a lot of inequities between the upper basin and the lower basin, and California and all of the rest of the states. Because the lower basin gets that full 7.5 million acre feet, the upper basin has already been doing a lot of work to conserve water. They allocate based on like a percentage of what is available rather than like hard and fast numbers, which is, I think, how the entire compact should be rewritten. It should just be a percentage of whatever water is available. But the lower basin refuses to do that. So they have like these hard and fast numbers where like at this level in Lake Powell, then Arizona only gets this many acre feet. And that's why in this recent debacle, Arizona ended up facing the biggest cuts. And I was talking to you guys about how tribes in Arizona are struggling to get their water rights. Well, the tribes in Arizona were some of the people who faced the largest cuts as a result of that. So it's just like this really weird power dynamic. The upper basin is basically like, nah, dog, like we're not donating any more water to you guys because California consistently uses more than they're allotted. So the upper basin will be like, hey, we're only going to use like 4.3 million acre feet this year so we can save some in Lake Powell. And then the lower basin will just use it all. And by lower basin, I really mean California because Arizona and Nevada, like they don't really use that much compared to California. And then the other thing is that when the federal government came out and was like, hey, we need to make these reductions, California literally in the negotiating room threatened to cut off cities like Phoenix and Denver before reducing the amount of water they would use for agriculture in their state, which is crazy, especially because we were already talking about how most of the water going to agriculture is going to cattle feed crops. That's very much true in California, where most of that water is going is the Imperial Valley, which has the oldest water rights, the oldest and largest water rights in the Colorado River Basin. And one third of the cropland in the Imperial Valley is to grow forage crops for cattle. And about 40% of the forage crops grown for cattle in California in 2020 were exported to China. So like we're exporting our water in the form of forage crops to other countries. We also export it a lot to Saudi Arabia. What's really funny about that, I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, but I think you're going to love it. So just bear with me.
Okay. Hit me.
So in Arizona, there's this farm called Fundamonte Farms, which is owned by Saudi Arabia. And they have a huge alfalfa production company.
I've heard about this.
Yeah. Yeah. So people are really pissed about it, rightfully so, because in Arizona right now, their legislature, I think it's their legislature, it might be their attorney general, but one of their elected officials is working on creating better rules and regulations for groundwater. But right now, a lot of the state groundwater is like basically unregulated. So all they had to do was like get the land permit and then they could just pump as much groundwater as they wanted, like for free. And what's crazy to me is actually the reason this is happening is because back in the 1940s, we sent people from Arizona to Saudi Arabia and we were like, hey, you should start growing some hay over here and we'll show you how we use our aquifers to grow hay. And like we went over there, we were literally like, this is how you should do it. And then in 2015, their aquifer ran dry. And in 2016, they made it illegal to grow alfalfa in Saudi Arabia. So that's why in 2015, they opened Fundamonte Farms in Arizona to grow their alfalfa.
Wow.
So, like, basically, the way that we manage water in the West is really ignoring a lot of the ecological realities of the West. And it's also disadvantaging a lot of communities that have already been oppressed by the American government. And I think it's about time that some of those inequities are addressed in, like, the legal systems that govern how we allocate water.
Obviously, the winner should be society, you know, but what we're thinking about is exports and money.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Sounds really familiar in terms of energy, but you know, but I feel like I just beat a dead horse at this point. So, curious, you've also mentioned something called the California Power Play, the CA Power? You have CA Power Player.
That's just my way of saying like California is the biggest player in the room. And like in the negotiations, after the federal government was like, y'all need to come up with a plan on how to reduce water, six of the seven states came up with like a really excellent plan on how to like deal with that. But it did require California shouldering a significant portion of the burden, which kind of makes sense because they are using more. But they vetoed it literally on like the last day before the deadline. They were like, no, we don't agree to this plan, which is super frustrating. And so basically, that's just to say that like California is basically the kid in the room that's like, my dad's a lawyer, you can sue me. Like the Colorado River Compact gave California all the keys to power. And it makes it really difficult for other players in the basin to act in good faith. And in my area, because I live in a rural area in Colorado, when irrigators are opposing like environmental organizations trying to secure water rights to protect rivers. For example, there's a river near me called the Dolores. It's the river I grew up camping on. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's a Red Rock Canyon. It's a lot like the Colorado River. It's a tributary of the Colorado River. But unfortunately, you can only raft it about once every 5 years because most of the time there's not enough water. We pump almost all of the water from that river up and out of it into a different river basin, which means that it will never flow back into that river. So like in 2021, the river was like virtually dry. It was at like one CFS or something like that. And when environmental groups have tried to secure water rights to protect that river, the irrigators are like, that is water that's going to go to California and like screw California. So wow. It's created this almost like hysterical perspective of like where water is going, because it's very much like everybody v California, and then other people look at it like irrigators versus cities. I just don't think that that is really helping us at all. Like, we really need to just look at the system as a whole and be like, wow, the system doesn't really make a lot of sense. Why did we do it this way? And I just want to throw out there that it's not like I'm the first person to be saying this. In the 1870s, John Wesley Powell wrote a book that was called like a report on the arid regions of the West or something. I don't know. You can look it up. I can't remember the exact name. But basically in it, he said only 2% of the land out West was arable. He literally told the USGS and like the precursor to the BOR, like, you guys are setting up like a legacy of litigation and conflict over water rights for your future constituents. Like, there is not enough water for the land. It's not just like me that's coming up with this. We've known this for over a century. We've just chosen to ignore it.
That makes sense. I mean, the watershed is what, mainly fueled by what, snowmelt, right? Water, snowpack.
Almost entirely from snowpack.
It's not a sustainable culture that they built, for sure.
Yeah. And then when you add in, like, we were talking about climate change earlier, like federal researchers just came out with a study, and I'll send you the link to this afterwards. But like, Colorado could lose up to 80% of its snow by the end of the century. And that's terrifying. They're saying Colorado might look a lot more like Arizona, which is crazy. Wow. Colorado is one of the only states that has no inflow water. We only have outflow water. And we supply water to something like 15 other states. So we're already dealing with a broken system, and then we're just like placing a bunch of extra stressors on it. And it's really not looking good for the future.
Rip Colorado, unless something happens. We're hoping that things change. One more thing, I think, before we jump into break, because you did quickly mention it, that there's this fight, and I don't know if you want to talk about it in segment three, but there's this fight between the urban interface and agricultural rural interface. One thing I really want to point out and stress is that in that study that I did mention before in the Journal of Nature, I can read it verbatim here, the urban water use has actually declined since the 1980s. It's been going down. So there's data out there, just without going into the actual numbers, there is data out there that suggests that the urban interface is trying to do what they can to conserve water.
Absolutely. There's this concept in the Colorado River Basin that they talk about a lot at conferences, which is decoupling water consumption from population growth. And there are quite a few cities within the basin that have already managed to do that, which is really, really awesome. But I still think there's work to be done, for sure. Yeah. And I'm excited to talk about some of the things we could do in the next segment.
Dang right. Okay. So with that being said, we're going to run into our commercial break. But then when we come back, I guess we are talking about what is being done and also conservation tactics. So stick around.
Are you an athlete who is constantly on the grind? Maybe you're a student who's cramming for an 8 a.m. exam the next day. Or maybe you're someone who's crushing a hike and you have three peaks to go. Well, you've come to the right ad. Sigma snacks are a healthy alternative to pre-workout and energy drinks. These snacks deliver easily digestible sugars and carbs necessary to crush an early morning workout, late night study sesh, or any adventure in between. By combining caffeine and the amino acid L-theanine, these bars are backed by scientific research to provide clean energy, extra focus, and reduce the anxiety and crash that are associated with normal pre-workout and junk energy drinks. Not to mention, they taste great. Specifically, I have been taking them with me on my backpacking adventures. They're a great way to start the day without having any jitters or an upset stomach on the trail. Lastly, Sigma Snacks is a student-run, student-operated startup that would like to offer you 15% off your first purchase with the promo code STEAM. So head on over to eatsigmasnacks.com and order your first Sigma snack today to have the best and most reliable source of energy shipped right to your door. That's eatsigmasnacks.com, promo code STEAM for energy that's out of this world.
Okay, we're back. This is segment three, and we're talking about what is being done and conservation tactics. So we're going to start out with something that I'm not good with at all. Teal's going to give you the rundown on what's being done with policy. So Teal, please take it away.
I want to start with explaining what kind of solution we actually got out of the seven states as a result of the federal government prodding them. They came up with an agreement to reduce water consumption in the lower basin by a total of 3 million acre feet over 3 years. So that's about 1 million acre foot per year, which is about 25% of the reductions that the federal government actually asked for. So there's definitely still work to be done. And they're going to be, as I said earlier, renegotiating the drought contingency plans for this kind of scenario in the next year or so. And the federal government is doing an environmental impact study to decide what kind of impacts the various possible changes, including that plan that I just talked about, would have on the environment in the Colorado River, because there are a number of endangered fish species. So they have to kind of go through this whole federal review process before they're able to make any changes in how we manage things. As far as like the federal government and like releasing water from dams. But at the same time, there are other entities in the basin that are like putting in good work to change things. And I would like to give the Southern Nevada Water Authority a huge shout out, because they have been on the vanguard of water conservation in the basin. For those of you that don't know what the Southern Nevada Water Authority is, they're the people who take care of all of the water in Vegas. A lot of times people will point at Vegas as this like the city of excess water use, but the reality is Vegas recycles almost all of the water that is used indoors, and they actually use that water to do a wetlands restoration project that is in the Las Vegas Wash, which is really cool. And they also are paying people to remove lawns. New developments aren't allowed to have lawns. The Nevada legislature passed a law that I think by like November of this year, cities and subdivisions have to remove non-functional turf grass. So they've taken a ton of steps to reduce their water consumption, and it's been successful. Their population has grown by something like 750,000 citizens, and their water consumption has been reduced by about 27%. So they're really crushing it. They're really leading the vanguard. I do want to throw out there that part of this has to do with the fact that Nevada doesn't have as large of an ag lobby to contend with when they're making these kinds of water conservation decisions. So there's like a lot of unification in the Las Vegas Valley around this effort, which I think is really cool, because like when I first went to Vegas, there was absolutely not in my mind that the people living there were like environmentally minded or like conservation minded. That's not what I was thinking when I went there. Southern Nevada Water Authority actually like flew me out and let me check out their whole water filtration system. They also have water waste investigators, which are basically water cops. They drive around and they write tickets for people if they're irrigating on the wrong day or during the sun hours, or if their irrigation is running off their lawn and onto the concrete. They're taking it super seriously. And what I think is really cool, the guy who runs that organization is called John Etzminger. And he recently kind of peer pressured a bunch of cities in the Colorado River Basin to sign a memorandum of understanding to adopt some, if not all, of the tactics that Las Vegas is doing to reduce cities' consumption of water. But again, we can't only focus on cities, because if we need to reduce the amount of water we're using in the Colorado River Basin by 25% and cities only consume 10%, yeah, we're just not going to get there. The math ain't mathing on that. I mean, you're the math expert. You tell me.
Yep. Math ain't mathing.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So what we really have to start thinking about is like how we could get agriculture on board. Like a lot of irrigators in the Colorado River Basin are still flood irrigating, like I was talking about earlier. And that's why we measure things in acre feet, because we flood the acre in a foot of water. There's benefits and drawbacks to it. Flooding a field does recharge the groundwater, which means like that farmer might be able to use that water again from a well, or in some cases that water might run off and go back into the river it came from, but only if the water hasn't been put through a transbasin diversion. And as I've said several times throughout this podcast, like, that's kind of the basis of our Western water law, is that we take water from one river and we pump it up and over a mountain or through a mountain to a different river or to a different river basin for people to use for agriculture there. That's what happens to that beloved Dolores River that I was talking about earlier. I think that flood irrigating should still be in use in some places, but there should be a lot more consideration to how much water is lost to flood irrigating. They say the plants only consume about 50% of the water that's flood irrigated, and then the rest is lost to evaporation or groundwater seepage. And I just don't think that's a very efficient use of our water if it's such a precious resource. So they say that sprinkler irrigation is somewhere closer to like 75 to 80% efficient, depending on like the environment and like what sprinklers you're using and like what crops you're growing. So using sprinklers can be really helpful. And then there is always drip irrigation, which unfortunately you can't really use drip irrigation on something like a cattle feed crop, because you take one of those big turbines over it to gather it, and that would just like rip up all of the drip irrigation. So that's not really a viable solution to having cattle feed crops. So that's another thing we need to consider, is like what kind of crop choices we're using. And like, perhaps it doesn't make sense for 60% of our water to be feeding cows. That's not to say I don't want to feed any of the cows. I'm just saying maybe not that much water needs to go towards it. There's like tons of different moisture sensors that you can purchase to put on your farm to be able to track moisture a lot closer and then not waste as much water. But the thing is, none of the farmers are going to start doing any of those things as long as the law discourages them from doing so. We really have to address that policy issue before we're going to be able to fix anything else. And a lot of farmers are really opposed to any kind of changes to water rights because they feel like the water will just be taken away from them. Changes that I would propose would be creating a legal mechanism for cities or states to compensate irrigators for their irrigation upgrades to own whatever their efficiency savings are in the future. I think that would be a really good compromise. Rural agricultural communities get to preserve their cultural heritage, but we're not wasting water in the way that we did back in the 1800s. Because a lot of these people are literally using the same headgates that their great, great, great grandpappy did on their family farm, which I love for them, but we gotta move along with the technology. And then we also had discussed this, which I'm really excited to talk about. I just put out a video about this today, but beavers could be so helpful to us. I'm gonna go into the why in a second here, but I just wanna comment on, like, I go to a lot of water conferences. And then the last year or so, people have started showing up with like beaver shirts and like beaver stuffed animals. And like everybody is really on the beaver train. Basically, the concept is that there used to be 200 million beavers in North America before we like mercilessly slaughtered them to create silly little hats. And now there's only about 15 million of them here. And beavers are really, really awesome species. They're what's called a keystone species. So they fulfill a really specific niche in an environment, and that means they help create the ecosystem they live in. They create ponds with their dams. Obviously, like a beaver hears running water and they're like, I must stop that. So like they build their dams and they build their ponds, which slows down the running water, which allows it to seep into the groundwater. Mm-hmm. So part of climate change is we see these really spiking hydrographs, which is like when the snow starts melting, it like melts, it gets really hot and it melts really fast and it's gone. And so we kind of just see this like pulse come through, and the beaver ponds kind of like help absorb some of that moisture as it's coming down and then release it later in the drier months. And they also perform a lot of ecosystem services unrelated to like water resources alone, but they cool down nearby air temperatures and they create really amazing fire breaks. So areas that have beaver ponds are often unimpacted by wildfires when they come through.
There was a wildfire in Idaho in 2018, and 65,000 acres were burned. The green spaces that were left over were built by beavers.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I'm in my video that I just released, I talked about it, but like, what if we could solve the climate crisis with releasing 185 million beavers? Like, I don't know. Maybe that's all we need. I'm joking, of course. Like, clearly that's not the answer. But like, I do think that we should start looking into these like nature-based solutions, because people spend a lot of money to do stream restorations throughout the West. And a lot of times they're building things called beaver dam analogs. And you do have to build a couple of BDAs to attract beavers to the area. But the thing about that is, if you don't reintroduce the beavers or like at least help support them, then you have to continually keep building these BDAs, and they cost like a lot of money when we could just be like paying for some beavers to come and like fix it, which would be great. The other problem is there's a lot of opposition from ranchers because ranchers get really annoyed with beavers flooding their fields, which I kind of understand. I do get it, but they were a part of this natural landscape, and I think it's important for us to use whatever tools we have at our disposal to try to like restore that natural landscape, because clearly it's what sustains us.
Yeah. So the positives to that definitely outweigh the negative of flooding a little bit of your field. Water retention, cooling the area, keeping, you know, wildlife safe from certain disasters, but also propelling wildlife ecology. There's a lot of benefits. Have you ever heard of the tactic that they used in like the 1940s where they like dumped a bunch of beavers out of like a plane with parachutes into like an area where there was no roads to get back to? So they just dumped a bunch of beavers out of a plane.
No, I've definitely heard of this and I'm like absolutely obsessed. My next beaver video will absolutely be including some footage of that if I can get my hands on it.
Please do. It's a great story. I could just imagine beavers just coming down and just scurrying out of the little boxes. Wonderful.
Maybe that's all we need, you know? I don't know.
I think so. To transition here, I think there's a few other things that I really want to talk about. And maybe we could talk about desalination. There's a lot of debate on how effective desalination is. Do you want to comment on that?
I do. Well, first off, I just want to comment on like this concept of like augmenting new water resources or adapting to the water resources that we have. And I really think it makes more sense for us to adapt to the water resources we have and put our resources, our like monetary resources, in that direction. Because in my mind, like, we can't keep augmenting water resources forever and ever and ever. Eventually you have to get to a place where you're like, all right, how do we operate with the water that we have? But addressing desalination as a specific way of augmenting water resources, I think people don't understand the scale of desalination that we would need to accomplish to be able to rectify this budget deficit and how much water we use. Like, the largest desalination plant in the world produces about 800,000 acre feet a year, and we need 3 to 4 million acre feet of water. That's not even considering like the amount of power that we would need to generate to run that, and then the brine waste that we would need to be able to deposit after that. So there's a lot of uphill battles there. And then the other thing, and actually I'm stealing this quote from John Etzinger from the Southern Nevada Water Authority. When I asked his opinion on this, he basically was like, yeah, I mean, be my guest, but like, it's going to take you a couple of decades and we need to figure this out like yesterday. So go ahead and start building your desalination plant today. But like, we should also be looking into like, how are we going to fix this now? Because that's a future solution. Even if we mobilized on the scale of like building Hoover Dam and had like the whole country put our resources into making this happen, it would still take like 5 to 10 years. That's my take on it. I don't know if you have any different thoughts.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are places, if we're just talking like not the Western United States, like there are places in the world that definitely need an answer like desalination. For example, I'm living in Israel right now. And one thing that Israel did was they got their quote unquote shit straight with their natural landscape. And then they said, okay, we need this amount of, you know, water. And so let's desalinate. And they actually did a really good job of estimating how much demand would come from that desalination plant. They've done a really good job with that. However, like what you're saying, like with the Western United States, I think, you know, it is good to create a tandem approach to solving this water crisis. But I think the answers are definitely in natural approaches. And I think that's something that we should definitely move forward with and be focusing on, rather than just fully focusing on something that could potentially help us out in half to a full decade from now. So I do agree with you.
I want to throw out there that I bet that I haven't looked into the way Israel allocates water. But the thing is, like I was saying, we allocate water as if it's endless. If we start desalinating water, we're just going to start allocating more than the water we can desalinate. And then we're going to be like, well, we need more water to desalinate. So until we like address the policy that allows us to just continually over allocate water, then like augmenting new water resources doesn't really do us any good. That's the way I see it. Like, I think desalination could play a really good role in like supplying water to the Metropolitan Water District in Southern California. I think that should be playing a much more critical role in their water supply. But I don't think feasibly that we could start letting irrigators use desalinated water to irrigate, because I think we would end up going down like a very dark path of being like, well, we need more and more and more.
It definitely doesn't solve the usage issue at all.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I totally agree with that. And just to one last comment on this, and just so people understand. So you talked about how we have this brine solution. Well, from my understanding is that the desalination plant that they have in Southern California, I think it's San Diego, for every 2 gallons that they process, like 1 gallon of it becomes fresh water. And that's a very generous estimate. So it's 50% efficient, but potentially a lot less than that. But what happens is you're stripping the salinity, the salt, away from solution. So what happens is you have a very high amount of salinity in what you put back into the ocean. We'll just say just the ocean. And that creates problems. That sinks to the bottom of, you know, the oceanic floor and creates some anoxic environment for a lot of different species that are in and around that ecosystem. Just bringing a little bit of awareness for what she meant by, you know, brine. There's people on both sides of the aisle that scream two different things. One person will say, oh, it has little effect. The other person saying, no, it's creating anoxic environments, which is no bueno. Just wanted to add that really quick.
I think that's a good call. Sometimes I get like so close to the issue that I don't remember to like zoom out and explain what I mean. So I appreciate that.
That's literally why I'm here.
Yeah.
So I love it. I guess another thing that I think would be fun to talk about that I brought up last night was about cloud seeding. Do you have any information about cloud seeding that you want to share with the audience?
Absolutely. Once again, I'm a policy person, so I don't really know a lot about the process itself. So maybe you can fill us in. My understanding is like we put like silver ions in the atmosphere and it allows like water vapor to condense around those particulates. And it's only about like 10 to 15% effective. But on a policy end of things, I can say that the Southern Nevada Water Authority and a lot of other entities in the Colorado River Basin actually fund a ton of cloud seeding stations throughout the Colorado River Basin, including in my home mountain range. And the jury's kind of still out on how much it's helped. I kind of think like the Southern Nevada Water Authority has very much taken an approach of like, let's just like throw it at the wall and see if it sticks. And I admire their like tenacity in pursuing possible solutions, but also I am really, really wary of geoengineering solutions to problems related to climate change. I really just feel like that's a runaway train that I don't really want us to get on. Maybe that's just me. I'm not the most educated in the science of it in today's day.
So I can maybe give my 2 cents here. One of the particulate matter that we'll just say particles. One of the particles or molecules that we want to spread in clouds, and this is something that has been around since, I can't remember if it was the 40s or the 60s. I feel like it's the 60s just to be safe. But anyways, that's silver iodide. It's exactly what you said. You introduce it into a cloud. Water vapor will want to readily form and create a crystalline structure with that. And what happens really is it forms the structure, it adds more weight, and then it becomes, you know, heavy enough and it falls out. Whether that is snow or rain, it depends. There is a pretty dark history to this from a sociological standpoint. There's been times where the US government has used this tactic without scientific approval, and there still is a lack of scientific data behind it. For example, we used it in the Vietnam War to try to prolong the monsoon season in Vietnam. If that worked, we have no idea because there was no science to back it up and really take fair measurements. And we've also used that before trying to see if we can alter the course and alter the end result of a hurricane. And it didn't turn out very well. It was something that was just like, yeah, we're doing it. And then we'll find out what happens. You don't mess with hurricanes, by the way. But from my understanding is that we are now starting to get some data. Kataya Frederick and her team from the University of Colorado actually proved in a couple of trials that cloud seeding does work to a certain degree. And you did state a number, I think you said like 15%. What they did is they measured its effects. They found that it does end up producing a certain amount of precipitation. But the problem is weather is extremely variable and extremely hard to predict. So to state like a definitive number of, oh, it's this, you know, level of effectiveness is very difficult. And it's going to take a lot more science to actually have something proven. And the last thing that I want to state is that, and I agree with you, we have to come at this with a level of caution, because if these authorities are just throwing silver iodide to the wind to get some form of efficient result, the problem is that molecules are all about dosage, and dosage can turn into toxicity depending on what you're talking about. We really don't know what silver iodide is going to do to every single organism in every single ecosystem. It would be stupid for me to sit here and say, oh yeah, we know exactly what's going to happen if we throw silver iodide to this concentration into the atmosphere. We don't. The spray and pray tactic probably isn't good.
I love that. What a good phrase though.
Literally, yeah, because I saw some videos of that, and it just, they're just like,
yeah,
taking these trailers and just parking them and then just spraying it out there. Yep. And I'm like, and no wonder why there's a bunch of woo-woo people on the internet going, oh my gosh. Yeah. But there is a little bit of merit to it. And I hate to like give conspiracy theorists like an inch, but like there is merit to it. And we do have to be concerned about our geoengineering tactics.
I listen to this podcast called You're Wrong About pretty frequently. And one of the like common threads in that podcast is that like there's usually a little nugget of truth in most conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. And that's like how people get sucked into them. So yeah, I mean, I absolutely think we should be focusing on figuring out ways to do what we're already doing with less water, and like how we can continue replicating that in the future.
I agree. So the last portion of this, I think we should talk about culture. And this was something that you really were emphasizing whenever we met the first time. So let's talk about culture. How is it affecting culture? What can we do?
Absolutely. Well, I just want to say that I think the only way we can get out of this crisis is if we instill an ethic of water conservation in everything, in our everyday lives, in every industry, in every city, in every community. We all need to take ownership of the watershed that we reside in, whether we're aware of it or not. Like, we're all citizens of a watershed community. Like, you live in a watershed. Everybody does. And so I think we really need to like start, you know, with kids. Like, we have to start with young people and getting them to like understand like the value of the water resources we have, and like the system we're operating under, and the way that it devalues those water resources. On the horizon, like, we have people that are taking our culture in the opposite direction. There are Wall Street management, like asset management firms, like there's literally one called Water Asset Management that is coming into Colorado and buying up water rights from the Colorado River Basin with the intent to sell them back in the future, which is that exact kind of speculative purchasing that we were trying to prevent from the use it or lose it. That company calls the current water crisis in the West a $1 trillion market opportunity, which is like enough to make me want to like form a union on its own. But yeah, it's a little frustrating to hear. But so we really like, we need our leaders and all of us individuals to really start like steering our culture in that direction. And like, I think there are water leaders that are starting to do that. I've already pointed out the Southern Nevada Water Authority. I think Colorado is doing a pretty great job. I do think that there's more that could be done. And I think just talking about these issues, like in the last year, we've started seeing people actually call out how much water is going to alfalfa. Like, when I first started going to these conferences, like just saying how much water went to agriculture was like awful. Like, you are saying the elephant in the room. How dare you talk about agriculture? So to be able to have like a frank conversation about like, yeah, we're sending a lot of water to cows is like really, really refreshing. And I'm excited to see like where that goes in the future. And I also think that the national media attention that the water crisis got is also kind of like pushing us in the direction of having a culture of like sustainability around water. For example, Pinterest does like a trend report every 2 years, and their latest trend report said that like drought and drought resilience planning is going to be trending in the next couple of years. And like, I think that's really cool that we're seeing it like trickle into like mainstream culture. I love that. I also think like in the basin, there's this like really strong mentality of us versus them. And it comes in a couple of different ways. There's like the upper basin versus the lower basin. there's the six states versus California, and then there's irrigators and rural agricultural communities versus cities. And I really think we have got to stop talking about these problems in this like zero-sum game conversation that we've been having. Like, we continually keep, the irrigators are pointing at the cities saying, you guys need to save water, and the cities are pointing at the irrigators saying, we feasibly can't get to 25% without getting you guys on board. And then there's people who are like, this is how my grandpappy's been doing it, and I'm not giving any water to California. And like, we all just need to take a step back. There's not enough water for all of us, and we all need to do our part in like reducing how much water we're using. I think the longer that agricultural communities in particular keep pointing the finger at cities and being like, you guys are to blame and we don't have to do anything and we have senior water rights, the less time they will have to adapt to the stark reality of how much water we actually have available. And with that, I want to give a warning. If there's anybody in this podcast who's from Colorado and they're like a rancher or a farmer and they're listening to this, like, I need you to be aware that Colorado's plan for dealing with drought in the future, if they ever can't fulfill the obligation of 7.5 million acre feet to the lower basin, is to pay irrigators to stop irrigating. So far, their plan is to do it voluntarily, but like, I don't really know how many irrigators would voluntarily sign up for this program, but they want to compensate irrigators to fallow their crops so that they can send that water downstream to California. And again, I really think we should come up with a legal mechanism that allows the state to upgrade their irrigation efficiency and own that water in the future. So it's not a zero-sum game. Because right now, these irrigators, either they use their whole water right or they sell the whole thing. And there's really no like in-between for them. And I don't think that's very fair. People from cities and urban dwellers need to stop looking at irrigators like you troglodytes who aren't working on this issue. Like, they care, and like they care probably more than you in the city, because like they see it. They see their fields withering. They see the river going down. Like, they're also deeply invested in this problem. And we just like really have to stop doing this like finger pointing thing, because it also comes from the other direction. I get so many comments that are like, Vegas is the problem. And it's like, well, you didn't even do your research, because Vegas is actually really crushing it right now. So we really need to stop looking at this problem like everybody's going to lose no matter what, and start looking at it like, we're only going to get over this if we all work together, because that is the reality. And with that, I also want to throw out there that like, we need to include Mexico and the tribes in all of these negotiations. And thus far, the tribes do not have a representative at the negotiating table for these drought contingency plans and any future changes to how the BOR is going to be managing the Colorado River Basin. So I think it's really, really important for us to create space for the tribes to speak their mind and have a say in their water resources. And I also think that they probably have traditional ecological knowledge on how to survive in a very dry landscape that we've been ignoring for over a century, and we should probably start listening to. So I really think part of the solution here is we need to like put Indigenous leaders at the very forefront of these discussions. And I just want to drop like a little bit of a proud Colorado moment, which is that Colorado and my corner of the state, the southwestern corner, just appointed a woman named Lorelei Cloud, who is the vice chair for the Southern Ute Tribe, as the water representative to the Colorado Water Conservation Board. And she is the first tribal member to be on that board since it was created in 1937. Wow. So we're seeing changes. It's happening. We're seeing these Indigenous leaders take over these positions, but it needs to happen faster, and we need everybody to get on board.
Yeah, that holds a lot of weight. You know, just having someone from a different background with that type of knowledge is definitely important, and can definitely sway things in the right direction. So that's very exciting. One thing I do want to point out as well, because you did name drop Mexico, for people who have Netflix and love watching Netflix, Netflix has a series called Explained. And they did an episode on the world's water crisis. And a good portion of that was dedicated to what's going on at the end of the Colorado water basin. I hate to get political, and I don't like it, but I will state this is like, I've had numerous conversations where people are upset about what's going on at the border. And there is a percentage of that that has to do with water. Imagine you being your dad and your granddad and, you know, his dad, et cetera, have had a farm for hundreds of years. And then all of a sudden there's just no water. So what are you going to do? You got to go somewhere where there's a job. You got to do something. You got to go somewhere there's water. Because if you know anything about the ecology of the northern portion of Mexico, it's freaking dry. And there's a correlation there.
Before this winter, like, Tijuana is a city that gets most of its water from the Colorado River, and they were having to shut off water for like days at a time because they just didn't have supply for the city. And a couple other things about Mexico, Vice News did a piece about how in the area of the Colorado River Basin that goes into Mexico, there's actually cartels that are like siphoning water out of the canals and like selling it. And it's like entering like the whole like criminal underworld, which is crazy. And also, like, a lot of cities in Mexico, they have trucks that deliver water, and the cartels have started kind of like paying off the drivers and stuff like that. So like water has become part of this like black market in Mexico, which I can only imagine also contributes to people wanting to come to our country. But the other thing, we talk about people because people and human stories are what drive our emotions and empathy. But I do think it's always really important to also talk about like the landscape. And like the Colorado River Delta in Mexico used to be gorgeous. It was one of the largest estuaries in the world. And Aldo Leopold, like the famous environmental writer in his Sand County Almanac, has a section called The Green Lagoons that's all about what the Colorado River was like in 1922 when he went there. He talks of a river with no end because there's so many different channels you can take. It is completely dry. The Delta flowed in 2014, and I think there was a little bit of a flow pulse recently, but like the Delta does not get water very often at all. And if you look at photos of it, it's like a desolate, dry, salty landscape. There's literally nothing there. And it's kind of horrifying to think that like we literally drained this whole ecosystem to grow alfalfa. I don't know. That's just like a weird thought to me.
If anybody ever winds up in San Diego Natural History Museum, I've been there, and they have a wonderful just section dedicated towards that whole like area. And you should definitely check it out. One more soapbox item that I really want to bring up, and I feel like you have a decent comment for this, is that I really hate the premise of bottled water. And it's like, okay.
It reminds me of like in The Lorax when that guy's like selling air. Like it's the same concept to me. Drives me nuts. I will throw it out there that I get a lot of people that like when I post about the water crisis, people are like, well, it's Nestle. And like water bottling companies are definitely not the ones driving this water crisis. But I still don't think that like bottled water should be anybody's go-to. Like, I think it's something that we should only use in situations where there's like no access to like clean drinking water. Other than that, you should just be using your tap water. Like you should be able to do your research and like know where your water resources come from and feel confident in like their safety. Like I feel confident. I know what river my water comes from, and I know what processes they use to make it clean before I drink it, because I've done that research, and I don't need to buy bottled water because of that.
So like for places like that get hit with natural disasters and stuff like that, like I understand the infrastructure is beaten and you can't trust the water. So you have to bring in bottles of water to get it to people that need it. I get that. I also understand places like Flint, Michigan, people buy water bottles because they have to. But again, at the same time, that's a failure of governance. And you know what really upsets me? Whenever freaking celebrities fly out to Flint and bring in like crates of bottles of water, instead of just donating like $1 million to like solve the freaking water system there, just pisses me off. Like, I'm sorry. If I had a quarter of the money they did, I would just be like, yeah, these people
deserve
water.
I'll just replace these pipes. Like, why is this a problem?
So getting away from the whole Flint thing, the bottled water thing just irritates me because we should be looking towards like government policy issues rather than just being like, oh, everybody should just go buy bottles of water and, you know, it ends up in the street, in the landfills, in the oceans.
So you're telling me that you're somebody who believes in systemic solutions, which I am also on board with. I get really annoyed with people asking me like, what can I do? Because like, yes, I totally understand wanting to like make a difference. I also want to make a difference. That's why I have my platform. Mm-hmm. But the reality is like, we have to fix the systems. Like we won't be able to address a lot of these issues until we like actually look at the systems and start weeding out the policies that we're using that are like causing these inefficiencies or redundancies or just like plain stupid things that we shouldn't be doing. The deeper you go into water policy, I didn't even get to go down all the rabbit holes. Like most of the way we manage water is completely disconnected from the reality of the environment. And it's just astonishing to me. And so, yeah, turn off your sink when you're brushing your teeth, but that doesn't help us until we like decide to actually manage groundwater in like a reasonable way and surface water in like a reasonable way. If that makes sense.
No, yeah. I encourage people, because we did a whole podcast called Sinking Cities. And one beautiful and devastating, horrible example of that is Mexico City, how it is literally just sinking. It's subsiding because they're just taking all of their reservoirs or aquifers just away. And it's so sad. To end on a good note, I do agree. Activism is the biggest thing that like an individual can do to make a difference. I stress that in every single podcast that we do that ends up talking about conservation or climate change in some aspect, because shutting your faucet off when you're brushing your teeth is very important, but advocating, talking about it, and advocating to people who do, you know, make policy is the most important thing. And a united society is a strong society. So instead of, you know, pointing fingers, actually talk to your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving and have common ground and talk about how water bottles are bullshit. So that's all I got to say.
Yeah. Know where your water comes from. Like, I think that's an important thing that a lot of people don't look into, is like where their water comes from. And like, most of the rivers in the United States have like a Friends of organization that you could, if you care, you can join it, and you can, maybe they have a citizen science effort, or maybe they have a river cleanup. But like, if you really care and you want to make a difference, you are going to have to like get out there and like do it.
Well, Teal, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has just been wonderful.
Of course, I've had so much fun. This is exactly what I was looking forward to.
See, the outline works, people. And with that, I bid you good night. That is all for this episode of Everything STEAM. I just wanted to take a quick second and thank Teal for sharing her expertise and experiences with regards to water in the Colorado River Basin. If you want to connect and see more of Teal's content, I recommend that you search Western Water Girl on Instagram and or TikTok. I would also love to mention my amazing team for their collective efforts to make the show happen. This podcast was edited by Ariel Piermont, and our episode art was created by Gabrielle Edmiston. After the episode, please give our podcast a rating and review on whatever platform you get your podcasts on. We're always looking for feedback, and the rating would greatly help us out in the fight against the algorithms. Lastly, be sure to check us out on all the socials for podcast news, upcoming episodes, and just fun STEAM content. Just search Everything STEAM on Instagram, TikTok, Threads, and Facebook to join in on the fun. Once again, thank you for listening to Everything STEAM. I'm your host, Sam Stanford, and as always, stay curious.